And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at KPFT Houston.
To Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Don's on engineering. And what have we got this week? Doing a Monday show is always kind of interesting because it's like, oh, you can go on the weekend. It's like, oh, there's some stories that are interesting, but you know that half of them are going to be displaced by Monday morning. Starting off, remember, harrisvotes.com, votetexas.gov. Make sure you're registered. Make sure you know what elections are coming up. I think there's some kind of a little election coming up. I have to do the research. Harrisvotes.com, you can find that out, and I should. Trump news. Deportations. Who needs judges and courts? Apparently nobody. So this whole protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, well, that's obviously a load of bull. There really need to be consequences. I mean, I realize technically impeachment is supposed to be the consequence, but, you know, it's kind of like perjury. It should be a criminal offense, maybe. I'm not saying should. I'm saying maybe should be a criminal offense when a public official blatantly violates their oath of office. Protect and defend the Constitution. Yeah, we don't need no court case judges. Yeah. Okay. Here's something I thought was interesting. The gun industry sees banks as a new threat to the Second Amendment, according to Lisa Marie Payne, Associated Press. A gentleman started offering one of his custom handguns for sale on a website. The company he was using to process payments weren't thrilled, and he couldn't find a credit card that would allow him to take money over the internet. It appears in the wake of high-profile mass shootings, corporate America has been taking a stand against the firearms industry amid a lack of action by lawmakers on gun control. Payment processing firms are limiting transactions. Bank of America stopped providing financing to companies that make AR-style guns. Retailers like Walmart and Dick's Sporting Goods imposed age restrictions on gun purchases. Quote, if a few banks say no, we're not going to give loans to gun dealers or gun manufacturers, all of a sudden the industry is threatened and the Second Amendment doesn't mean much if there are no guns around. So apparently, if the financing stops, there won't be any more guns around. Of course, the fact that we have more guns than people, I think, will keep us supplied for a while. If you can't make guns, if you can't sell guns, the Second Amendment doesn't mean much. Most of that is a quote. The chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho, sent letters criticizing Bank of America and Citigroup, which decided to restrict sales of firearms by its business customers over their new gun rules in the wake of the Florida high school shooting. Crapo wrote, we should all be concerned if banks like yours seek to replace legislators and policymakers in attempt to manage social policy by limiting access to credit. Now, I have to point out here, I'm sure many of you don't need me to, but I shall. I have to point out here the irony of so-called free market, freedom-loving Republicans all of a sudden telling the free market what they can and cannot do. I mean, I know that there are, you know, technically there are things that they can and cannot do, but there is a certain ironic hypocrisy that goes on. You know, they're very selective about their small government, big government contradictions. He goes on to say, we may have to seek legislation to make sure it can't be done and you can't discriminate against individuals from lawful exercise of a constitutional right. Another irony, because the Supreme Court defines constitutional rights all the time, but that doesn't stop Republicans from legislating against them. I think it's an interesting sort of bit about the banks and the guns. This is intriguing. It's definitely something we should follow as sort of a story and a trend. But I think I've read enough of that. Okay, why was Sarah Sanders asked to leave a restaurant? This is by Dean Obadala of CNN. And he makes a couple of interesting points. I'm going to read some of this a little bit at length. I'm going to try to abbreviate. I think most of you know that on Tuesday night, DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen was harassed by hecklers, protesters, at a D.C. restaurant, a Mexican restaurant, over her defense of Donald Trump's family separations at the border. And then on Friday, according to a White House tweet, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was politely asked to leave a Lexington, Virginia restaurant by its owner because of her work defending Trump and its policies. Those shocked by these types of protests simply can't grasp the level of emotion, he writes, that many who oppose Trump feel. Obadala hears it nightly on his Sirius XM radio show, sees it firsthand on social media. And even Trump, in a rare moment of honesty, told supporters a few weeks ago that those who oppose him are not just angry, but really, really angry. Many view Trump as a true threat to America. But Obadala goes on, let's make this clear. This is not about asking someone to leave or heckling them simply because they're Republicans or conservatives. That would be wrong. This is about targeting people who are very publicly involved in formulating and defending Trump's immoral policies. Stephanie Wilkinson, owner of the Red Hen restaurant in Virginia, who asked Press Secretary Sanders to leave, told media Saturday that she is, quote, not a huge fan of confrontation. She says, I have a business and I want the business to thrive. But as Wilkinson rightly noted, quote, this feels like the moment in our democracy when people have to make uncomfortable actions and decisions to uphold their morals. There's some other stuff that I cited that you can go online. I didn't have time to finish my blog post, but most of it is there. But here's something that Obadala says that I think most of us, and certainly I, agree with, quote, as a progressive, Obadala says, I feel that denying service to a person is instinctively troubling. For many, it may conjure up laws that banned blacks from being served at restaurants before the Civil Rights Act and the current campaign by some on the right to turn away same-sex couples who want professional services for their weddings, or even a gun range owner who declared no Muslims were allowed on the premises. But the situations with Sanders and even Nielsen are not in the same universe as these discriminatory examples. No one is targeting them for their race, religion, or sexual orientation. The backlash is because they have freely chosen to be a part of the Trump administration and have personally defended Trump's policies. In fact, Nielsen has served up lies while championing Trump's family separation policies, while Sanders even evoked the Bible, telling reporters it is very biblical to enforce the law. There's more. I don't want to read you the whole article. You can go to the website and click on the link. But, you know, this is a tough debate. A few weeks ago, when a right-wing guy was chased out of a bar, I guess you'd call it, a club, and he was heckled out by Democratic socialists who basically did not let him quietly have a beer. The guy wasn't saying anything. He wasn't chanting anything. He wasn't disturbing anything. He was just having a beer. And the question I raised was, if 1929 Hitler went in to have a beer, wasn't saying anything, wasn't disturbing the peace, wasn't making any racist comments. He was just having a beer. Would it be right to heckle him out of the beer parlor, out of the beer garden? As opposed to, say, 1933 Hitler, which is sort of a very different thing, because by 1933, Hitler was in power, you know, burning of the Reichstag, martial law, taking over the government. I'm not sure there was an actual martial law, but equivalent. And I think that we are sort of addressing now, again, these questions. When is it right to harass a public official for doing their job, give them the benefit of the doubt as they see fit? And in what way is it reasonable to protest? I'm not going to use the word harass. That's really the wrong word, because I don't want to use that word. This is different from harassment, I would like to think. So in what way and at what point is it reasonable, fair, doesn't cross an unreasonable line to protest or disrupt a time, a public time, a private time of someone who is instrumental in a policy with which you seriously disagree? Now, for me personally, the Nielsen protest, where these folks just marched into a privately owned restaurant and verbally assaulted Nielsen, you know, did perhaps reputational damage to the restaurant, did perhaps psychological damage to of one sort or another, major, minor, whatever, to the diners, ruined their experience, innocent bystanders, you know, what military sometimes calls collateral damage. And how was that more effective than, say, waiting outside the restaurant to protest to her as she was leaving? You know, these are fine lines. These are distinctions. Is it appropriate to protest someone or to ask someone like Sanders to leave because of the policy she's executing? She was asked politely. The owner apparently discussed it with the help who are serving her. So, you know, these raise very uncomfortable questions for liberals, for progressives, for people of legitimate conscience and who really believe that the good of the country is very, very really at stake. And then, of course, there's the slippery slope question, because what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Now, where is the argument going to settle here? Is it going to be an argument of, well, the right has been doing this kind of stuff for a while, the left is just catching up? Or is it going to be, well, the left started it, and now the right has essentially been given permission to do it? It's a similar question to, how is the United States, after Trump, hopefully, going to be able to reassert itself on things like democracy and human rights around the world when it's like, well, look what you guys did, you great democracy? You know, once you give up the moral high ground, I think there's sort of like a Trumpian fence to get back to that high ground. Don't know. I should mention that we do have a phone number. This will be a conversation. You guys can call in on this or any other topic. 713-526-5738. 713-526-5738. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. You can support KPFT a couple of different ways. You can send money. Money's always nice. You can go to kpft.org. You can donate using a credit card, a debit card. You can find ways to mail a check. Heck, you can bring stuff to the office here at 419 Lovett. You can donate cars even. You can call 713-529-4000, and you can be advised or leave a message to be advised on how you can donate, for example, a car or a boat that maybe you haven't been able to sell or you want to get a tax deduction for. And sometimes the tax deduction you get, you know, is perhaps worth as much as or more than what you might actually be able to sell this thing for. But, you know, other ways to help KPFT, tell your friends. If there are shows on KPFT that you enjoy, whether it's the music shows or the talk shows or the informational shows or the shows that don't fit into any clear category, Tell your friends, you know, 90.1 FM, if you have forgotten, they're still on the air and they're doing some really interesting programs. And for example, there's this one guy on Thinkwing Radio who's probably the most conservative liberal at the station. You know, just a little variety. So, you know, you tell two friends and they tell two friends and so on and so forth. Anyway, all right, so I know I've got Johnny on the line. I just want to touch on a couple more things. Associated with the article, you know, Trump wrote a tweet about this terrible Red Hen restaurant, needs a paint job. The awnings are filthy. And the Daily Beast wrote a short piece titled, Trump's Roach-Infested Restaurants Are Vile Compared to the Red Hen. Seriously, some of the health code violations in these places are disgusting. And it goes on a little further to say, by contrast, the conditions at restaurants at Trump's hotels and resorts have ranged from moderately unsanitary to outright revolting. In April, Washington, D.C. inspectors visited the Trump International Hotel and found 10 health code violations, including raw meat stored above ready-to-eat foods and containers of flour stored next to a hand sink that lacked a splash guard. Inspectors also found the hotel was operating a number of on-site kitchens without city permits to do so. The hotel was given a moderate risk rating. Whereas the health reports on the Mexican restaurant that Nielsen was thrown out of and the Red Hen, apparently they don't have any health code violations. So, you know, take it as you will. Maxine Waters warns the Trump cabinet, steel yourself for more public confrontations. And this goes back to that earlier bit I was talking about. What kinds of confrontations? How should they be executed? Where are the boundaries? What is right? What is wrong? What is fair? What is not? There's also one other story I just want to mention very, very briefly. I saw it online, didn't think to make a note of it, so I've just scribbled it down. There is a story that was called Brexit the Big Short. I may add it to today's show blog. But here's how it goes. Nigel Farage and his Brexiteers, as they call them, when the vote on Brexit was taking place, the polls had just recently closed, and apparently Nigel Farage and some other, I'm going to call them co-conspirators, had already seen polls saying that Brexit was going to win. This is not something that was done overnight, by the way. This was a long-term decision that was negotiated and made that I think would, you know, define as a conspiracy. And by saying, well, I think Nigel Farage, I think that Brexit is going down. I think that the Remains are going to win. So, of course, the pound shot up on the news that the Brexit vote was going to fail, that they would remain in the EU. But Nigel Farage and his cohorts knew that the actual polling was showing that no, as the count proceeds, in all probability, Brexit is going to win. They shorted the British pound. So when Brexit won and the British pound took a dive, they made billions. Billions. And they did it, you know, you could argue, I think there would be SEC rules in the United States. I don't know what the rules are in Britain. I'm betting they're kind of similar. This is market manipulation. This is false news, knowing that it is false news in order to manipulate the markets. That's a conspiracy. We'll see how that goes. Okay, we have open lines. We had somebody, and I think we lost them, call back. 713-526-5738. 713-526-5738. I promise I'm going to do less talking now. Johnny, how are you doing today?
I wish I could tell you we're doing better, but unfortunately, it would be at least another 6 months before I have a better clue.
Yeah, at least.
Listen, you're bringing up that same argument of 1929, Germany, Hitler, and the reason why I disagree with it is because we are not at that same point. We already know our history, and we refuse to acknowledge it, but if we actually paid attention to our history... Some of us apparently have, because they're the ones that are going to the restaurants and shaming these people.
Well, I'm not saying this is
1929. We're in the early 1930s, and Hitler is in the White House.
I am not disagreeing with that. I'm saying that my original...
righteous for our side, to behave the way they're doing towards these people. They need to be shamed.
Well, what I was bringing up was that we had had this discussion on air a few weeks ago where I had said the 1929 Hitler versus the 1933 Hitler. I didn't say that we're still at 1929. I agree with you. We are somewhere in the early 1930s.
Okay.
So,
as long as we're on the same page.
Oh, yeah. We're definitely on the same page.
One last thing. This jacket that so-called First Lady was wearing, all these mysterious messages that we on our side are trying to come up with, you know, it's just plain and simple. From the point of view of the poor brown people who are scared for their lives here, and the word gets back to them, the translation from English of what she had on her jacket, that's the ultimate for me. That's the bottom line. Her message is to them, not to Donald, although it might be too. That's irrelevant. He can't be touched by her or anyone else. Otherwise, he would have been impeached by now.
Mm.
The message is she doesn't care about them. She doesn't care about being First Lady. She doesn't care about kids. She's a fashion model. She was a gold digger. You could tell in her body language she's not a caregiver.
I think that, you know, assuming that you are a kind of person inclined to give people the benefit of the doubt, whether it's they didn't mean it the way it sounded or they were tone deaf, you know, it's not like being evil, it's just being stupid. That's possible, you know, people can be stupid. You know, there's a saying that I used to use, that never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity. But, you know, the stupidity is too consistent to be inadvertent.
That's right.
So,
we've had more than 11 years of this stuff now from the far right about their language and they're only kidding and this and that. We all know that's not true. It's bogus. And she should know better. She obviously didn't have to do that. She knew what she was doing. She does not deserve to be in this country. The first person to have her passport reevaluated should be Melania Trump, not these people who actually benefit this country way more than she could ever hope to.
Well, now, Melania doesn't, well, passport, yes. I believe, does she have a green card or citizenship at this point?
I think she's got her citizenship by now, but her citizenship file should be reevaluated. If her husband is talking about reevaluating other people's citizenship.
Yes. Yeah, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Yeah, there you go. We're like on the same page on that. Yeah, I mean,
we're on the same page. That's good.
This stuff gets to be troubling, concerning, ironic, scary. You know, there like aren't enough adjectives.
Hey, before I hang up, let me ask you, did you catch Democracy Now! Edition this morning?
No, I don't catch anything in the morning.
Okay.
I have enough trouble getting here at 2.
On the internet and catch it before you go to bed. Just look at the lady who was interviewed. Her first name is, I forgot now. I'm drawing a blank. She's an advocate for Latinos. And she herself is on the chopping block, literally. And she earns a living for herself and her family by being a consultant for issues related to the Latino community. And she does translation work, too. Anyway, I found her very inspiring, and I tried to make a donation to her, sent her an email, and hopefully I'll get an email back as to where I could send a donation to, because if anyone is worthy of it, she is. She's worthy of citizenship, not Melania.
Well, you know, at the very least, one of the things I mentioned last week, and I think that most of our listeners at least would agree, is, you know, especially since illegally crossing the border is a misdemeanor and not a felony, and it's usually ejection and a fine, there are much worse crimes for which there are statutes of limitation that after a certain period of time you can't be legally charged. It would, you know, murder is one of the ones that doesn't have a statute of limitations. I would think that crossing the border should not be in the same category as murder. There must
be a
statute of limitations on illegal entry into the country, particularly in circumstances where somebody has established a livelihood, a family, they've blended into the community, they don't have a criminal record, maybe they've established businesses.
They have essentially proven themselves to be genuine Americans.
Yes.
Quote, unquote.
Yeah, and there has to be a statute of limitations on something that is a misdemeanor, when things that are serious crimes, felonies, do have a statute of limitations. I mean, it's logically a simple
one
thing.
One thing you just reminded me before I hang up. There's this visual of undercover activists photographing a small handful of young Latina girls a few nights ago in the dead of night. Did you see that video?
Maybe not.
Okay. Well, it occurred to me while I was looking at this, from behind, that these girls were all light-skinned, and they could easily pass for Caucasian kids. And then the ugly thought crossed my mind. What if the Trump administration or people within the administration, unbeknownst to Trump, but knowing how he thinks, are selecting white-looking Latino kids and having them spirited away and put them into the adoption and foster care programs of these United States. And that way, that's another way of them lightening up the color of America and punishing those adults who come across.
There's nothing I can dismiss as impossible from this regime.
Boy, we have agreement on lots of stuff. There's hope for you yet.
We are living in...
Did you hear that, Mike?
What's that?
See, this is just the one bad thing about Magic Jack owned by Republicans. I said there's hope for you yet.
Well, I didn't say that I'm... You know, people, you have to understand. When I say I am the most conservative liberal at the station, that is not to say that I'm a liberal conservative. I'm a conservative liberal. I am liberal on almost everything. I put the conservative in because I'm basically pro-military, and I kind of have some fiscal concerns about managing budget and interest rates, and those things make me a little bit more conservative. On social issues, I'm all to the left.
Yeah, I'm a left-lefty. But that's okay. We agreed on three, four things today in a row, which
yes.
is pretty good.
Yeah, not bad. Not bad.
Not bad at all. I just hope I'm wrong about the backdoor selection process that's going on, trying to whiten up America by kidnapping these kids.
Well, there may be a much more...
Putting them into some kind of sex industry, because you know our part of the country is famous for that.
There may be a much more direct way to lighten up the country. Apparently, applications for asylum from Russians... is way up.
Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that's a lot of pale blondes right there.
All right. Coffee's not black. It's blonde.
Yes.
That's what they think anyway.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. Okay. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. We have open lines, 713-526-5738. Remember, KPFT is a nonprofit, community-supported station, 501c3. Donations are tax-deductible. You can support by going to kpft.org, donating money, large, small, medium. We're okay. We'll take whatever it is you feel you can manage and afford. Also, tell friends. Shows you like, tell friends. Maybe they'll like the same shows you do, or maybe you'll hear about a show that you don't listen to that maybe you think they'll like. That's okay. Growing our audience is a legitimate way to help KPFT. Phone number is 713-526-5738. We do have open lines. Going back to this Brexit, the Big Short article, you know, actually, I think I might be able to pull it up. But let's see. While I'm working on that... Maxine Waters, we already did that one. Oh, here's something interesting. The U.S. Supreme Court, this is new. The U.S. Supreme Court upholds Texas redistricting that a lower court said discriminated against black and Hispanic voters. The case is Abbott v. Perez. The court decided today. Largely upheld the Texas congressional and legislative maps. Alito wrote for the majority. It was a 5-4. Merritt Garland, we miss you. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote a dissent longer than Alito's majority decision. Thomas and Gorsuch added they do not believe that the Voting Rights Act applies to redistricting. My understanding is that one of the things it specifically applies to is redistricting. After the 2010 census, Texas was awarded four new congressional districts. Because of the state's population growth, all the growth came from an increase in black and Hispanic residents, but the new maps produced a legislature that fulfilled its goal of protecting Anglo-Republicans. At oral argument, Roberts said the state's adoption of the 2012 court-drawn boundaries ought to give some presumption of good faith moving forward, which is significant in the determination of their intent to discriminate. The case was one of three gerrymandering cases considered by the court this term and the only one involving charges of racial gerrymandering. I think North Carolina is coming up on the docket as well. So let's see. I just want to... I'm sorry? Don? Oh, okay. Sorry. He wanted to call my attention to the fact that we have a caller. Okay, I just want to bring this up, and of course it's not letting me. Okay, Judith, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. I'm just, you know, trying to do a show and find an article simultaneously. It's like walking and chewing gum. How are you doing?
Not easy. I'm good. How are you, Mike?
Okay, thank you. What's on your mind today?
Well, you just made a statement that I don't understand, and I would like to hear your explanation for it, and maybe we can discuss it so I'll have a better understanding.
Okay.
You said that you're the most conservative liberal, KPFT, and that you're, and if I'm trying to get the gist of what you said.
Sure.
That you're socially liberal.
Yes.
But that you're a military person.
Pro-military. I didn't say I was a military, no, because I'm not a veteran. I don't want any misapprehensions, but I have said succinctly that I think that an expensive peacetime military is still cheaper than an expensive wartime military. So I'm not for wars. I am for a strong military deterrent.
Okay. But my problem in understanding that is the actions of the U.S. military. And I've been around for a long time.
Me too.
And all over the world, you know, what we've done is we've invaded countries. We've taken down governments that were democratically elected. And we say we're promoting democracy, but we're not, because we put in rulers that are not democratic at all. What we're doing is supporting our commercial interests and the pocketbooks of the very wealthy. And as I see it, we are not going to get the social programs that we need in America or anywhere else in the world until we curtail our military. And our military is not our primary source of income. Our military contractors are not, you know, major source of income for the United States. I think our ego has got to be curtailed.
Well, if I may, I think that there's a difference between conceptually supporting a strong deterrent military and approving of the policies for which that military has been used over the last 10 or 15 years.
Well,
I mean,
yeah,
longer
than 10 or 15 years. And I understand your point about a strong military. But the thing of it is, it seems to me that in America, we have confused strength with brutality.
Yes, I
and
agree.
And greed.
Yeah, I'm not so far distant from that either.
Yeah, I know you must not be. And I think this is something that a lot of people don't realize. The MIC, the military-industrial complex, and our
an Eisenhower term, by the way, not some extreme lefty. A lot of people don't realize when they hear that term. That was Eisenhower's farewell address.
Oh, I know. You know, Eisenhower warned us about the rise of the military-industrial complex.
Do you know why he was a Republican? Do you know why he ran as a Republican? And I'm pretty sure of this, and I don't think that many people don't.
I don't.
It was kind of like when Ulysses Grant decided to run as a Democrat, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Military people are professionally apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time that both parties were courting Eisenhower to run for president, And he was making a decision whether he wanted to run as a Republican or a Democrat, because whoever, whatever party he ran with, he was going to win. And the decision that he made, as I understand it, was that between FDR and Truman, there had been 20 years of essentially Democratic rule. And as I understand it, the decision that he made was that if we were to continue to have a viable two-party system, the Republicans had to have a turn at power. So his decision, not so much ideologically as philosophically, was to run as a Republican so that the Republicans would have a share, an opportunity to share power for the first time really in 20 years.
That's interesting.
So, you know, when you look at it that way, it isn't as much of a surprise that he was pro-union, pro-social welfare, pro-worker. I think that he was the originator of the Adams for Peace program, where we wanted to help countries not develop nuclear weapons, but nuclear energy, hoping that it would be a cheap way to spread electricity throughout the world. So, I mean, you know, this whole Eisenhower thing, it's really, really interesting because he was not like a lifelong professional Republican, as I understand it. He made a calculated political decision to give the two-party system another chance.
Well, that's interesting, and I wasn't aware of that. Thank you for sharing that with me.
But going,
I think that his point is so on.
Yeah, and, prescient.
You know, I've been a voter for a very long time. And I voted Democrat, and I am no longer a Democrat. I'm just simply not going down that road, and I'm certainly not a Republican.
Well,
the thing of it is, both of our parties are wedded to the money that it takes for them to get into office. And as long as the military-industrial complex has the power that it does because of our government spending by bought people in our government,
and politicians come cheap,
contracts and pursuing arms sales to destabilize the world. As long as they have that money, they're going to have that power. And the only way we're going to get lessen that power is by lessening the amount of money that they get. I'm not saying at this point in our history and where we are in the world, you know, that we should throw down all of our arms. What I'm saying is that we need to stop supplying other governments with weapons that they use to commit genocide. We need to stop brutalizing other countries. We are not the world's police force. We have no right to overthrow other governments and other people's choices of how they want to run their countries, whether we like them or not. And it's not that we don't like their political ideas. It's that we want their resources. We want the money.
Well, it can be both.
Well, it can be both. But mainly, and I was just reading an article from, let's see, what was it? I've been reading several of them. I can't come up with the name of
Well, let me say this. I mean, along the lines of what you were saying before, you know, I like to think, up until not too long ago, I like to think that by and large, you know, the United States, I have no illusions that the United States has always done the right thing. I think it may have been Winston Churchill that said the United States will always do the right thing when every other alternative has failed.
I partially agree with
you. Yeah,
that.
I mean, I do it even when
every other option fails.
I mean, I'm not so foolish as to think that everything we've done was morally, ethically good, or even politically, geopolitically smart. You know, I've gotten to a point in my age where I think there's a lot to be said for the Prime Directive. You know, not interfering in the natural development of a society. I think that when you look at history, it starts to become sort of apparent that, generally speaking, the stuff that you change ends up being worse than the stuff that you had before you changed it. And yeah, Cyrus
that's
Vance.
An interesting concept.
I'm going to say just one more thing. Cyrus Vance should be famous, if he's not famous, for a great quote. I think he was talking about the Somozas in Nicaragua when he said, you know, well, he's an SOB, but at least he's our SOB. And, you know, during the Cold War, it mattered from a geopolitical standpoint where your allies were geographically and what they were politically, economically, in terms of resources or just geographical strategic positioning. You know, all of this stuff, they say that countries don't have friends or enemies. They have interests. And I like to think that the United States does believe in having friends. And I like to think the United States does believe in common values as being a basis for international friendship. You know, it's never always been so. And with Trump, it's like, well, we don't need no stinking friends. We've got enemies we can be friends with. It's just...
Well, it's important who you consider enemies and who you consider friends. And the minute you consider a person an enemy... just because they don't agree with you, then you've set up a barrier to ever, you know, that nobody can cross.
I don't disagree with that. I think there's a difference between an enemy, an adversary, and a country with which you don't necessarily have a good relationship because you don't see eye to eye, but they're not necessarily posing a threat to you. I mean, that's like having a neighbor you don't like, but you still share a fence. I think Don wants to make a comment.
I agree with that. But the thing of it is, our military is 12, 15 times larger than the combination of all the other major militaries in the world?
That isn't exactly the statistic, and I don't know that you can actually equate that. What apparently is sort of common wisdom is that we spend more on our military than the next 9 or 10 countries combined. But that isn't the same as saying it's 9 or 10 times larger.
Okay. Well, I can't quote the exact thing. I've just been I've been reading a whole bunch of stuff lately, and I've probably got some of the facts mixed up. But I would agree with what you say, that we spend more, you know, than a whole slew of folks combined. And so we have no real threat. North Korea is not a threat. Russia doesn't want to fight with us because they're not stupid, you know. And until we stop being brutish in our foreign policy, and this is not just Trump.
No, it is not.
This goes way back.
It goes back to the end of the Soviet Union when we became a unipolar power and we felt like the constraints were off because the Soviet Union was no longer a threat to us. And I think that was a seriously misguided strategic change.
I certainly agree with you. And it's our ego now that's keeping us going, our ego and our greed, because we want to be first, we want to be best, and we want to be richest.
Well, for what it's worth...
It really doesn't matter who we step on to do it.
For what it's worth... The leadership of the United States, for better, worse, or in between, has led to the longest period without major power wars in modern history. It's been almost 80 years since the end of the Second World War. And, you know, there are wars. There are civil wars and there are conflicts between small countries. But something on the scale of the First and Second World Wars has not occurred. We have more of a rules-based international order, which is the work of the United States primarily. And yes, we do benefit from that politically, economically, geopolitically. And Trump is undoing all of that. And, you know, it's making things like the Crimea land grab, if not more acceptable, at least more likely.
Well, you know, I find it hilarious that we point to other people's land grabs, looking at what we've done in just since 2000, you know? I just find it, it's to me,
Well, define land
grab. As I said, I'm no longer a Democrat. But when I hear the Democrats say, we're not as bad as the Republicans.
Well, they're not.
That's their motto.
I mean, seriously, you cannot compare whatever you think of the Democrats. To say that the Democrats are the same as the Republicans is an absolute false equivalence. I mean,
no,
Trump is not Hillary.
I'm sorry?
Trump is not Hillary. Whatever you think of Hillary, most of which is 30 or 40 years of right-wing propaganda, character assassination, most of it. The fact is, Hillary is...
It's her voting record and everything that she said.
She's not Trump.
I didn't listen to Russia.
She's not Trump. No. She's not Ryan. She's not McConnell. She's not any of those people. You have to admit that we would be on a totally different trajectory under Hillary, no matter what you think of Hillary.
Well, I agree with that. We'd probably already be at war with Russia.
Oh, God, no.
Oh.
Well, I'm going to back up. Well, hold on. I'm going to back up from that.
Yeah.
We might be in a conflict. I don't know that it would be a military conflict, but I think that Russia would be involved in a well-earned cyber conflict with us.
I think it would be a military conflict.
Maybe.
Because I think Hillary backs fracking. She backs... oil exploration.
None of that has to do with Russia. I mean, we need to stick to the point.
I'm getting to that. Okay. She backed the policy in the Middle East, the no-fly zone, which would have brought on military conflict with Russia.
At the same time, everybody was arguing we had to do something in Syria.
She supports the military-industrial complex, and she... By increasing the fights we have around the world and trying to justify them in some means, then she promotes the gross national product or whatever. Whatever I'm trying to say, you understand, I'm sure. We can come up with the words. I can't come up with the right words right now.
I get that there's a lot of hunger out there for a third party.
Yes,
but. Until we have elections that are decided by a majority rather than a plurality, third parties do nothing but disrupt the system and deliver people like Trump. If you want a third party, and I've said this for years, and I've had people that disagree with me and others that actually think I have the right plan, if you want a third party, don't be running for president. Run for city council. Run for mayor. Run for governor. Run for attorney general. Show us how you'll govern. Show us what your policies are. You want to build a third party? Do something real. You know, don't be Jill Stein. Don't be Bernie Sanders. You know, build a third party from the bottom up, not from the top down. And make sure that you can't do a Paul LePage and win two terms as governor, never getting more than 38% of the vote because it was a plurality win. That's my concern with third parties. And until we have majority win elections, I cannot vote for a third party for high office.
Well, I think we need to change our entire voting system. I think we need to get rid of electronic voting.
We need a paper trail. We need a paper trail.
Yes, we absolutely do. And I think, and I, you know, I'm not schooled on this, but from what I've read, ranked choice voting seems like the way to go for me, because that way people can actually vote what they want rather than from their fears.
It's an imperfect but better solution than what we've got. There are ways that doesn't work either. I've read some articles. I don't remember the specifics, but it is a better system than what we've got if implemented correctly.
Yes.
Australia,
yes,
I think, has a ranked system.
I'm sorry. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I knew it was around places, but I didn't know where, and I'm not that, you know, I'm not conversant in it. It's just that I've read enough that I think that it's a better choice. And I think that we better do something quick.
Well,
and I think that I'm not a burner anymore. I was, and until I found out that he was, I voted for Barack Obama because he didn't vote for the Iraq War. I became interested in Bernie Sanders because he didn't vote for the Iraq War. I voted against Hillary Clinton because she did vote for the
Iraq War. So you're a single-issue voter, essentially.
I'm sorry?
You're a single-issue voter, essentially.
No, but there were other reasons, too. But I realized that until we stop being a bully in the world, take care of our own business, and start being peaceful instead of greedy and bullyish and killing people, you know, anytime we please, there's never going to be world peace.
Well, I'm sure you and I could get down in the weeds on very micro-specific issues. In general, I think we're in agreement.
Yeah, I think so, too. You know, I just think that we have to take the emphasis off of, how can I say it without sounding, being first, being best. We have to start cooperating and get rid of our racism, our hatred, you know.
We were doing a good job of that up until about 2000. I mean, we were making progress. 2000, to me, that's when this whole thing started to turn around. Of course, Trump has given permission.
Yeah, he has. And Trump is bad news. But Trump is a symptom. He is not the problem. He is showing us the nasty face of who we are.
Well, he is both a symptom and the problem.
I'm sorry?
He is both a symptom and the problem.
Well, yeah, I would go along with that. I mean,
I have to give Don a chance. Don has been just kind of trying. He doesn't want to be rude and break in. But, Don, what was it you were thinking you wanted to add to this?
I believe it all breaks down to something that we haven't had in a long time, is accountability. That America hasn't been held accountable for anything that we've done. We've been able to bomb hospitals. We've been able to do pretty much anything we wanted to, but nobody's held us accountable. We can hold every other country accountable for the wrong things that they do, but because we're such a quote-unquote superpower, it makes it so everything we do is legal. And that's why Trump is the way he is because nobody's slapping us on the wrist. Nobody's saying, hey, we're not going to trade with you because of the way that you treat your people or the way you treat other countries. That is a huge problem. We can hold Canada up to some kind of standard and then say, no, but we're fine. That's
ridiculous.
Insane. Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that this country needs to be held accountable by UK. The UK just sits there and goes, well, it's just, you know, it's America. We really can't do much about it. Oh, well, our lights are...
yeah. Isn't it wonderful? Yeah. We have 6 minutes to go, and all of a sudden, three callers come on the line. Guys, you got to help me out with that. Okay,
well,
Judith.
Let me tell you, I so appreciate what... Is it Don?
Don. Don's the engineer.
Wonderful. Right on point. Exactly. Thank you. And I'll get off the line and let other people talk.
I appreciate your call, Judith.
Thank you.
All right, Bye-bye. Take care. All right, Clayton... we have another person coming on. Okay, so Clayton and whoever John is talking to now, we'll get you on. So Clayton, because a couple of people dropped off, you've got about 2-3 minutes.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make the comment that I believe it's totally irrelevant to look in the past, to think about Hillary. There's no way she's going to be a factor anymore. And the only thing to do is look forward. And
that was only in the context of Republicans versus Democrats and third party. That was where that came up.
Oh, man, that's a joke to even think about that, even debate about it or talk about it. With things so much on the line, with so many things on the line, so many things that we're losing, so many things that are, I mean, Trump is just a mob boss, and he's just casing the joint, and him and his criminal cronies are all just, they're saluting our country blind. And we need to make a big, huge change and root out the corruption.
The question is going to be whether the 18 election will be legitimate. We don't have a voter fraud problem in this country. We have an election fraud problem in this country, and that's the thing that scares me the most.
That is scary. That is scary. And all we can do is hope that the mass volume of people will still override that.
If enough people turn out, it's much harder to manipulate the vote. All right, Clayton, I'm going to have to let you go, but I appreciate you calling.
Thank you so much. Great show. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay, next up is Kurt. Kurt, you're on.
Yeah, hey, Mike.
Hey.
You know, you're going to have to get Judith her own show. I used to say that MOD needed its own show, but maybe the two could co-host one. But anyway, I agree with you on the military thing. And I don't think Judith quite understood that, you know, while we support soldiers and the military, we do not support the military-industrial complex and the total waste that's going on there.
I would like to see some trust busting in terms of dividing up some of these big aerospace and military contractors. I think there's too much consolidation.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's just, you know, the hogs are feeding at the trough, and the soldiers and airmen and sailors and Marines aren't. They're not getting
and
the
Coast Guard. They're part of the military too.
Yeah, they are. And as a matter of fact, you name a branch of the service, and I will tell you a member of my family that is serving or has served in it. So I'm kind of gung-ho in that regard, but I sure as heck do not support the so-called military-industrial complex.
Can I take a minute of your time on the air in order to make a historical contextual reference?
Please do.
Before the Second World War, now, the First World War, we weren't prepared for. We also weren't prepared for the Second World War. We had planes that were obsolete in 1939. We didn't have enough weapons to train our troops. Some of them actually started training with wooden guns. The draft passed by one vote. Otherwise, we wouldn't have even had a draft in place for the Second World War. We ended up fighting essentially a two- or three-front war. There are, in my opinion, as a non-military scholar, as a layperson, there are two seminal events in U.S. military doctrine. One was the result of the Civil War, and the other was the result of the Second World War. And ever since the Second World War, we have become a global power mostly in self-defense. We have always had a one-and-a-half or two-and-a-half war strategy, because while we're defended by oceans, at the same time, it's very hard to conduct war across two oceans. And increasingly, those oceans are not so much a defense. So the trauma of Pearl Harbor and the horror of the Second World War generally in Europe and the Pacific is the philosophical force behind the U.S. military position in the world right now. I'm going to give you 20 seconds to respond, and then Don's telling me I got to go.
Okay, understand. I couldn't agree with you more, Mike. Love the show. Thanks.
I appreciate that, Kurt. Call back earlier. Okay, you've been listening to Think. I always say that. It's just, this is why I need a two-hour show, Don, because people just get worked up in the last 15 minutes.
No.
All right. Well, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and Don, who will never give me a second hour. Maybe if I get enough donations during fundraising, we can talk about it. But I will be back next week. The week after that, we'll see. I'm not sure what's going to happen for the July 9th show. I may be off that show. But thank you all so much for listening. Thank you for the callers. Thank you for those who enjoy the show and think about it. Remember to support KPFT. Remember to vote. And have a great week.
If you've heard a KPFT pledge drive before, you've probably heard this line a thousand times.
Our volunteers are here to take your call.
But volunteering at KPFT is more than pledge drives. It's the folks who help pack your thank you gifts.
Or the people who spend a Saturday painting walls or helping at a booth or even distributing KPFT flyers around town.
You may hear a lot about volunteers during our pledge drives, but helping out at KPFT is an around-the-clock endeavor.
Why wait for a pledge drive when you can volunteer today?
Call 713-526-4000 to learn more about volunteering at KPFT or visit kpft.org to download a volunteer application to indicate your interest.
Talk with one of our great staffers to find out how you can help.
Again, that's 713-526-4000 to learn more about volunteering at KPFT.
Or visit kpft.org to download a volunteer application to indicate your interests.
This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio.
KPFT Houston.
On Thursday, June 28th, Texas troubadour Dale Watson will take the stage at Discovery Green for a free concert in the heart of downtown Houston. Dale Watson stands alongside Waylon Willie and George Strait as one of the finest country singers and songwriters from the Lone Star State. He's built a worldwide fan base that goes from Texas honky-tonks to Tokyo performance halls and all points in between. Austin rockabilly singer Celine Lee will open the show. Concert begins at 7 p.m. Picnic blankets and lawn chairs are welcome, but no glass containers or outside alcohol beverages, please. Food, wine, and beer will be available for purchase. Don't miss Dale Watson and Celine Lee on June 20th.